The theme for the evening talk is deeper than mindfulness. Sometimes when we are exposed to teachings and practices, it is quite often that there are particular features which are emphasized. So we might hear a wide body of teachings and instructions, various kind of guidelines which are given to us. And out of all of that which we listen to, perhaps one, two or three points may stay rather strongly with us, understandably. And one of the most common in this tradition is the word mindfulness, and it is used quite extensively, and some teachers emphasize it greatly, and it gives the impression, or some of us the impression, that a sole purpose and aim of the teachings and the practices is in order to be as mindful as possible in every moment of the day. And therefore, the sitting, walking, standing, reclining forms, everything is pointing to being a mindful person in daily life. It's tragic. And so we look to that. And sometimes, I don't know, perhaps you have done, but we find people in day-to-day life who we could consider, do and might consider, mindful, and live quite a mindful life. It shows and reflects itself in the manner. It might show and reflects itself that they are able to find anything in their home. And it shows and reflects itself in day-to-day life with regard to goods and items, etc., etc. Sometimes the meditator too is able to become a mindful person through the day. And that may show itself with regard to some kinds of ways, and perhaps the most common way is when there is some mindfulness and there is some bringing together of some concentration, and the bringing of the two brings a kind of communication to us of sitting, walking, standing, etc., being mindful, being concentrated, and just exclusively and perhaps narrowly as well just doing that throughout the day. And in that thinking, that's what the technique is, and that's in fact what vipassana is as well. Sometimes, when there's a lot of concentration, which I'm not speaking in virtuous terms, you might pick that up, when there's a lot of mindfulness, what can happen is that the meeting of the two in the day forms a kind of force in the mind. And what I mean by that there is a meeting of the two, they are rather held tightly together, and the mind is able to keep it that way, and so one sits with this kind of mindset, one walks with this kind of mindset and goes through the day. And sometimes people can appear to be, and may well be, quite concentrated. It's a little bit less likely in this kind of social environment, simply because of the sheer distances between places. In some places, and I'm referring to my own centre as well as others, that people arrive with a view that the teachings are exclusively around this consolidation of mindfulness concentration, and it shows in the manner. And so walking, whatever it might be, 15 meters from the meditation hall to lunch takes approximately half an hour. And the person is going extremely slowly, looks very mindful and concentrated, and may be able to sustain that throughout the duration of their 1 week retreat or their 1 month retreat or whatever the period of time is. But of course it's acutely vulnerable to the surrounding and supportive environment, and rather quickly and often sooner than later, that consolidation called mindfulness concentration begins to dissolve, and right after it, called the end of the retreat, called in England getting on the train or whatever, it seems like something is deteriorated or evaporated or faded away very, very quickly. Unfortunately, in this kind of mode of the yogi, of the dedicated meditator, there is something else which is going on as well. And what is going on is this compelling tendency in meditation towards believing that intensity is what it's about. So therefore the most easiest form to gather and gain intensity is being a kind of deadly, and that's probably the right word, deadly serious yogi whose mind isn't going to wander one single moment. And when the intensity in the meditation is actually building up, it's becoming more and more intense, with its concentration, which is a word that the Buddha has never used incidentally, with its mindfulness, put that intensity together and it gives a certain impression and a certain idea that that's what it's all about, and that is going to get me somewhere. And there's a certain kind of compelling attraction in this formulation. And then it tends to be fed, of course, with various heroic stories, Siddhartha Gautamas and various Zen masters and Theravadins living in the cave and Tibetans sitting in the snow or whatever other boring activity they do. And it all feeds this idea of intensity and concentration and mindfulness. Sometimes in the collective force of this going on, in the middle of the day or in the middle of a sitting or whatever, it can just literally crash around one inside of oneself. And then it begins to generate other manifestations. Sometimes agitation, restlessness, anger, fear, trembling and shaking in the body, confused states of mind, fear of going crazy or whatever. Yet, as I said earlier, how easy the residue of impression is that concentration, mindfulness and intensity is what leads us somewhere. God knows where. But that, and then it becomes some kind of proof of one is really on the way. On the way to what? One daren't speculate. So perhaps there needs to be, particularly those amongst you, and there's a fair percentage of you, who have had plenty of exposure to retreats, weekends, 7 days, 10 days, 1 month, 3 months, etc., who may need to re-evaluate and to look at it again at exactly what is taking place inside of oneself, and is one in fact investing in those two components, along with the intensity that I referred to, and maybe something else is being missed in all of this. And what can happen, again, to support all of that, of course, which is not what it was ever intended, is method and technique. That becomes the kind of gluing factor to hold one rather tightly into that. And what the outcome of that, how easily it becomes trying to force the mind to control the mind. The mind will cooperate temporarily. That's all. It will cooperate temporarily. It won't bring a liberation, though. It will just, there will be that cooperation. As I say, in the generally on a short-term basis, i.e., if one's lucky, as long as the actual retreat or the course lasts. So sometimes we have to take, for those of us who are exploring over some days, weeks, months and years, the field of meditation, and the majority of you have here, one has to take a genuinely second look, a reappraisal of how one's relating to the process of meditation, and seeing in all of that the relative usefulness and the relative validity of mindfulness, and to see if, in holding to it with the concentration, there is in fact something else, other factors being neglected, which in fact matter as much as the mindfulness. Something else in the flow of things needs to be truly present. Sometimes I remember once in one having worked, if I may say a slight aside here, but having worked, of course, over the years with many teachers, and sometimes it isn't easy. I think somebody might have made a comment to, in one of the small group to the other teachers today, as an example where if you listen to more than one teacher, there is almost bound, even with our solidarity and mutual connection, to be some differences, hopefully not too big, between modes of instructions which are actually given. And if you listen to me at 9:30 in the morning and you listen to Stephen at 4:30 in the afternoon, or Catherine or whatever, listen, bound to be some differences in emphasis. On obviously it's quite necessary to be able to make allowances for that. And sometimes in listening, I always remember one of the teachers, this was on the in the United States I was teaching with, and giving the evening talk, one of the very occasionally happens, very rarely, that I found my head going this way, and the which is rather naughty, I must confess, the teacher said the Buddha was mindful in every single moment of the day. And I thought, I wonder where that conclusion was drawn from. A, don't remember him actually being around 2,500 years ago, but more importantly, it expresses the making of the ideal about something called mindfulness. And there are plenty of examples in the Buddha's teachings and in the message and in his personal life too, where clearly on some things he wasn't so mindful on and wasn't so aware about at all, and had to undergo significant shifts of views due to some encouragement, meaning pressure, from his friends. So sometimes we have this idea, as I say, this view of continuity in time of being mindful every moment through the day, and that is what these teachings are about. It may happen, but what happens if we take attendance and look in another way with regard to this? But firstly, before touching upon that, because it's a major theme here, when we look at the totality of the day, yeah, in that, there's the general timetable for the day, 5 till 10:30. There is the encouragement from us to participate in the fullness of the day. Sometimes, some people arrive, and the self has already got itself reborn in the moment, and one says, I like to be on retreat, but I'll do my own thing. And the self and my own thing arises with some people, I'll go and sit when I feel like it. I'll go and walk when I feel like it. Sometimes we don't realize how easily and alarmingly quickly we've dissipated all of the challenge, all of the discipline, and the self is caught in itself. What it wants, what it likes, what it feels like doing. And then the characteristic of all of this is one finds oneself wandering round the Negev desert, not knowing whether one is on foot or horseback, hither and thither, here and there, usually steering a very wide circle away from what? Here. In the name of the self, which says, I'll do what I feel like doing. Quite forgetting that the teachings are about the investigation into the self. It's the investigation and the exploration and the insight and understanding how very quickly in life the I, the self, arises, and before we can blink three times, we are carried off on some stream which in fact is classic avoidance. The self is trying to run away from itself. Not a chance. Not a hope in this whole existence. Because the running is the self running. And wherever we go in life, it will go with us like wood goes with trees. And by the time we've connected with this, the silence has ended and we've all gone home. The time we realize, gosh, had 5 days together, what a pity, I blew it. I blew it because the self was in one of its points of time, easy to get into, where it's living on its whims. Understand this English word? Living on a whim. Living on an idea. Living on a feeling. Living on a self or whatever. So in coming into a focused way, that focused attention and bringing that focused attention in doesn't have to be intensity. One can approach even walking through this door, which some regard as walking into the hell realms, one can approach the movement into something in a relaxed, accommodating, embracing and attentive way. Attitude matters. Intention matters. And if we can say, let me allow myself to witness existence in front of me, that means one's own existence. Let me allow myself to place myself in situations and really witnessing what is arising. Perhaps out of that ability to be receptive to that will come some genuine insights and genuine understanding. And we begin to realize then it's not really the concentration which is the issue. Something else is much more important. And some people, having a little experience of working with people, somewhere between 10 and 100,000, some people seem to have that kind of concentration which I was referring to. He or she may do nothing but sit all day. never do anything else apart from eat and sit and eat and then sit again. And seem to be terribly well concentrated. And some people have that ability. No assurance of any insight, no assurance of any realization, no assurance of any discovery other than the fact of being able to concentrate the mind, be mindful and stay put on the cushion. Well, hens stay very much on their nest all day when they've got eggs inside of them. I hope those who can just sit all day won't be reborn as hens. So sometimes we have this idea that goes on with us, and we've inherited it. We weren't born with it. Somebody has told us. Somebody has given us the idea. Somewhere we have reduced to what we have listened to. And the teachings are much more expansive and bigger than all of that. And hopefully each person in this room can say, yes, of course, obviously. So therefore, for the serious yogi, it may, as I say, mean and require from us a genuine looking back and saying, am I actually moving towards liberation, or am I actually developing more finiteness of my mind and my heart and my whole being? Am I actually closing myself down in a restricted way, like I said, or am I actually opening up the life totally and radically? And sometimes, and sadly, sometimes we get confused between one and the other. And it's not surprising, people who keep repeating the same thing, keep talking mindfulness, keep talking concentration and intensity, whatever, must, if there's any wisdom inside left, must, in the attention to that, be wondering, why this repeating again and again and again and again? Therefore I say sometimes we need to stop. An important factor in all of that, and part of what the days of the retreat are include, of course, are matters of the heart. And just before speaking of that, if I may, I just want to make a couple of points clear here. Those of you who've been around the insight meditation scene for a long time, and maybe too long, will have heard the word metta. M-E-T-T-A. Now, when I began teaching, metta was a little event at the end of the retreat for 5 minutes, like those of you who sat with me will know. And we generate metta to all beings, and it's important. And often when we end a sitting or a talk, we might say, may all beings live in peace, may all beings live in harmony. It's a demonstration, it's an expression of concern and outer awareness. But the main criticism that was made of Vipassana for approximately 2,000 years was that it was dry. This was the favourite word. Well, I never understood the word dry when you're sitting on a cushion, but anyway, the word dry was the metaphor. It's rather a dry practice. And so people would say, well, can't we make it wet? And so years ago, which I've just actually reintroduced, at the end of the day in Bodh Gaya in India, we play some music. This is the wet and other things which people, anyway, so there was a lot of concern about all of this. And then some of the teachers began to bring and introduce more metta, that means more loving kindness, and used methods and techniques basically drawn from a 5th century Theravada text called the Visuddhimagga. It's the path of purification. And And in that is a basic, which some of you will know far better than I. Three kinds of people in the world. Could say the good, the bad, and the ugly, but not in this case. It's the friendly, the unfriendly, and the strangers. And one develops metta to those beings. And gradually, in the circles that I move in, more and more teachers are giving metta retreats. Mercy, loving kindness retreats. And Sharon Salzberg wrote a very successful book. I can't remember the title, but anyway, a very successful book. Very much on metta practice, loving kindness practice. And that brought more heart into it, and people have expressed much appreciation for it. So some people may think, or have the thought, maybe, this is a metta and liberation retreat. Oh, no, it isn't. It is a love and liberation retreat. And though there will be, and I hope Stephen, perhaps at the end of the day, will give a short metta meditation, it's not one of using metta techniques to substitute them over and above the rather tough, wretched world of vipassana, or of facing one's existence. Some people say to me, "Oh, Christopher, I like the metta, I feel so good." Oh, what a pity. It's the direct clear seeing which matters. The direct clear seeing requires, however, heart. So each time we use here mindfulness, though we may not say it, though we ought to, when you hear the word mindfulness, please, on bended knees I say this, please hear the word in the same breath, heartfulness. This will safeguard you from intensity. This will safeguard you from the anguish of trying to keep your mind concentrated every moment for the day. And this may open up life. So, in the flow of things, what would it mean to walk on the earth mindfully and heartfully? What would your relationship be like to the step? What would it be like when you go to the dining room and the mindfulness of eating instructions, which are generally speaking, naturally, be mindful, chew the food well, let it flow down into the system, and for God's sake, remember to leave a little bit of space in the stomach for the food to chew well inside, so that won't look like a corpse for the rest of the afternoon, because I'm so exhausted with undigested food. But if we also bring to it heartfulness there's going to be some further expansion of our awareness too. There's going to be respect and sensitivity. There's going to be some acknowledgement of all the beings that make it possible for us to eat, and the kindnesses of the cooks and the staff as well, and many others who make it possible. And it's going to be, I would say, a more caring, respectful, and sensitive awareness to this daily activity called eating. It may be that in that there is, of course, some mindfulness there, but there's something else deeper in the inner life which needs to have the chance to flow through. Right, supposing we look at our day and we say to ourselves, in hearing some of this, I want to live my day as consciously as possible. I want the day not only to be a conscious day, but also one which exercises the certain disciplines of the day. and therefore I will make use of the forms. I'll sit and I'll stand and I'll walk. I will be extraordinarily aware, and I'll stop in the moment when I see myself wandering around like a headless chicken, and I'll see that taking place, and I'll bring a focus and an interest which has in the movement of the being, and this is important, in the movement a certain purposefulness to walk respectfully in life. And as a meditative walking, there's a certain purposefulness what we're doing. And one can sense in the very body of the life itself certain purposefulness in what we do. And that purposefulness contributes significantly to harmonizing the being together, sitting, walking, standing. The calmness of being has an opportunity to come. The mindfulness will give support. There will be a sense of connection through feeling as well. And if we have got purposefulness there, the quietness of the discipline, the mindfulness there, the heartfulness there, and that goes together, then we have samadhi. S-A-M-D-A-D-H-I, samadhi. Most of you, all of you should know the word. Those of you who have not been on retreat before, half a dozen of you, won't be familiar with it. It essentially means a certain depth of being, a depth of presence. One doesn't have to be, for samadhi, which the Buddha taught, one doesn't have to be concentrated on an object for it. One can have samadhi, have mindfulness and awareness, and not be concentrated. Your own experience will see this for you. Through your own experience, you can see this for yourself. Then we say, okay, I want to live the day, make the day a really meditative day. I'm not going to waste a lot of energy, as I referred to. I'm going to make the walking and the sitting periods count in the best possible way. I'm going to make my day have a kind of purposefulness through the day. Then, as one person said in the small group today, I think a very, very important point. And she said, and this is her sixth day here on the retreat, she said, just paraphrasing a little bit, but I do want to expand on it. He said, I realize that quite often I look at my life and I just see the hours and the time and going by. And sometimes, she referred to elsewhere, I get to the afternoon and I think, common thing, where did the morning go? You know, or whatever it might be. But then, when there's more depth and I'm stabilized, actually, there isn't much difference, between the morning and the afternoon, the middle of the day and the evening. There isn't even so much a sense that I, the self, am passing through the day. That the whole idea that the day can be divided up is human mythology. The whole idea that so there is a difference between 5 a.m., 6 a.m., 7, 8, 10, 12, 5, 6, 10 p.m. in the evening or whatever, 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever it might be. There's a real, that we can divide the day. That we can make the day different, one part of the day to another day, is foolishness. It's naive. It's a deception of the self. And sometimes, in the samadhi, and in the depth of being, and in the stillness, we actually can be more clear. What's the difference between yesterday, today, and tomorrow? Where can it be shown? Yet, our life, and the deception of the self in the life, actually believes there are real differences between yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Show me them outside of what the mind makes. Who could show differences without bringing in the mind to fix them? And sometimes there is that calmness of being that I referred to. There is the stabilizing of the inner life. There is a sense of presence with it, that which is the samadhi. We're quite clear and receptive. And as the person said in the small group, that world, I'm paraphrasing here, of before and after, what's the difference? So there is something about the essential feature of the here and now, and the presence of it, which is in fact more important than the method and technique, more important than the form, certainly more important than wandering around in circles. And that becomes more of the outer. And sometimes in our sitting, in our walking, in our standing, in our stillness of being, and in particularly in our silence of being, something is discovered which has got nothing to do with being mindful every moment through the day. Nothing to do with being concentrated and a very intense go-getter meditator. Just seems rather extra. Such situations, such silences of being, to me, I would say, that's what really matters. Sometimes, as I mentioned, with all of this, we kind of get in a certain kind of groove, a common one. It's understandable. Some people say, oh, I like retreats, but I don't like small groups. Oh, really? And then the thought then arises, well, I'll keep away from the small groups. They only distract me. Arising of the self, arising of views and opinions, statement of mind is formed, one has decided, etc. It might be based on past experience or whatever, the view, or it might be based on conjecture, that means an interpretation, or whatever. One forgets in all of this that the small groups belong to the daily life here. That in entering into a situation like this, with the various agreements, the ethical guidelines, the silences, many other things there, one of those agreements too is in terms of the small group situation. Why? Because it's another opportunity to get potential for some deep insight and understanding within the context of the small group. And when a person says, oh, I don't want to go to a small group, I mean, after all, it's 45 minutes out of my whole day. That when one has this kind of view, which does arise, here, I call it arrogance. It's the arrogance of the mind which says, I'm myself, and I don't want to either be bothered listening to others, be available and present for others. And with that kind of view, somehow or other, the support for the small groups needs the presence and the attention of everybody, of the people in the group. Sometimes, of course, one does not want to go to a group, and we haven't rented any cowboys with a lasso to drag you over to the chairs. So one may miss a small group. You know, we're not sending out the alarm signals or looking for the bomb disposal squad or anything. But if you miss one, please ensure that within the next 24 hours, you make sure you're at another one so that you attend that one. It is part of the agreement of being here. Because sometimes, I'm speaking now as a Dharma teacher here, Sometimes when people say, I'm not going to do any small groups, I'm not going to do any one-to-ones, we have to, we end up spending more time over that person and then 100 or 150 or whatever the number on the retreat is, because of one person whose self is deciding and not able to find 45 minutes for the day. And sometimes every other day, it's not as though it's every day. So the cooperation and makes, apart from making our life easier as teachers, but also sometimes, as you know, those of you who participate in small groups, sometimes the voice of the other person is our voice. What we hear from the other person in the group is exactly the same as what we're feeling, what we're thinking, what we're saying, and what we want to know about. Or the comment of another person, or the experience of another person, and whatever she or he is sharing, it actually generates an insight for ourselves. And we could dismiss that opportunity because the self has decided in its own conceited and arrogant way, I don't need that. And some people say, oh, I have to spend all my life in groups, the psychotherapists and the body workers and the healers and others. And therefore the impression then goes on to that, and understandably it creates a resistance. But here we want to make the silence a catalyst for insight and realization. We want to make the evening teachings a catalyst. We want to make the inquiry. We want to make the small group. And it isn't always so easy, of course, in going deeper into these things to find that balance through the totality of the day. And sometimes it's that give and take which is required there. Finally, on the teachings and going deeper. Two elements in all of this which are precious and which are, if we understand them, absolutely lovable. And sometimes it takes a while for the heart to feel the kind of love and almost the intensity of the love in that very healthy way that I referred to. And the two elements are silence and stillness. And silence and stillness is something which very easily in our life becomes quite alien to us. And we can forget the tremendous importance of it as a relevant element. It's quite different from a quiet day. You and I can have a quiet day, not talk to anybody. Pretty easy here, isn't it? We can have a quiet day, kind of relaxed, easy day at home, not answer the phone and attend to various things, etc. That's a quiet day. But a day of silence is genuinely another dimension altogether. And it's something palpable. Palpable meaning something which one actually touches with the being. There are times in the meditation hall, sometimes collectively, because I hear it in the responses afterwards, and sometimes individually, where this palpable silence is felt extraordinarily profoundly in the hall. It's a silence which runs deep and actually is emerging not only into the cellular life, but also in its depth emerging out of it. And if in our awareness and in our receptivity and in our stillnesses and in our presence and in our samadhi, in and through all of that, there is the extraordinary potential for that silence which is profound and deep and which is pregnant for liberation. Sometimes, as I say, is actually felt far more than words will ever be felt. And as I say, it happens sometimes in the collective. And over the years in various parts of the world, people had a sitting, and then perhaps there's been a small group meeting or whatever afterwards. And several people have come out and they've had one thing which has registered powerfully with them, and that is the presence of that silence and what was coming through that silence. The Buddha himself was called Sakyamuni. Sakya means he was a Sakyan, that was the nation that he came from. Muni means silent one. Such an emphasis in this body of teachings of the significance of a silence which allows something to reveal, which is enlightening, which is truly liberating. And therefore, in the process of liberation and in enlightening the life, our silences, in other words, deeper than the quiet, is actively and honestly contributing to the liberation of others. Therefore, we are servants of silence. Therefore, we bow down before silence. Therefore, we give and sacrifice and we offer all our life into the silence and trust in it. All of that is part of the body of the teachings, which, as I said earlier, is going deeper than mindfulness. It's going somewhere else, which is illuminating and liberating. And therefore, every person in the Sangha, every person here, every single one of us, no matter what our roles are here, is actively engaged in the enlightenment of everybody else. And if you and I can have a sense for that, in all the things that go on with our day, I find, and I know my friends do as well, find that inspiring and encouraging, that whoever one is,